You don't have to worry about boulders chasing you or flying off a snowy mountain today. And everything else? Rufus shrugs. You're probably good on the headless birds, too. It sucks that that was the last time I'll ever dream. It wasn't even a good one.
Delilah Gray, 11:08 a.m. Infinite Weekly has secured Howie Maldonado's final interview. Delilah herself hasn't. I know everything about Howie Maldonado, Delilah says, but her boss, senior editor Sandy Guerrero, isn't having it. You're too new for a profile this important, Sandy says, walking toward a black car sent over by Howie's people. I know I work in the absolutely worst cubicle with the most ancient computer, but that doesn't mean I'm not qualified to at least assist you with this interview, Delilah says. She comes off as ungrateful and arrogant, but she won't take it back. She'll move far in this industry by knowing her worth and by landing a byline in this piece. It may have been Sandy's industry status that persuaded the publicist to choose Infinite Weekly over People magazine, but Delilah grew up with not only the Scorpius Hawthorne books, but also the films, all 8 of them, which nurtured her love for this medium, from fangirl to paid fangirl. Howie Maldonado won't be the last person to die, I'm pleased to report, Sandy says, opening the car door and removing her sunglasses. You have your whole life ahead of you to eulogize celebrities. Delilah still can't believe how low Victor sank last night with that prank deathcast alert. Sandy gives Delilah's colorful hair a once-over, and Delilah wishes she'd respected her editor's hints to dye it brown again, if only to gain her favor right now. Do you know how many MTV Movie Awards Howie has won? Delilah asks. Or which sport he played competitively as a child? How many siblings he has? How many languages he speaks? Sandy doesn't answer a single question. Delilah answers them all. 2 awards for best villain, competitive fencing, only child. He speaks English and French. Sandy, please. I promise I won't let my passion get in your way. I will never have another chance to meet Howie. His death can be life-changing for her career. Sandy shakes her head and releases a deep breath. Fine. He's agreed to the interview, but there are no guarantees, obviously. We've reserved a private dining area in Midtown, and we're still awaiting confirmation from his publicist that Howie has agreed to this setup. The earliest Howie may see us is at 2. Delilah is ready to sit in the car with her when Sandy shakes her finger. There's still time before we meet, Sandy says. Please find me a copy of Howie's book, the one he wrote. The sarcasm in Sandy's voice is so sharp, she doesn't need air quotes. I'll be a hero if I get a copy signed for my son. Sandy closes the door and lowers her window. I'd stop wasting time if I were you. The car takes off, and Delilah pulls out her phone, walking toward the street corner while looking up phone numbers for nearby bookstores. She trips off the curb and lands flat in the street, a car honking as it approaches her. The car brakes a couple feet away from her face. Her heart runs wild and her eyes tear up. But she lived, because Delilah isn't dying today. People fall all the time. Delilah is no exception, she reminds herself, even if she's not a Decker.
Mateo, 11:32 a.m. The clouds are gathering as we walk into Evergreen Cemetery. I haven't been here since I was 12, the weekend of Mother's Day, and I cannot for the life of me tell you which of the entrances will help us reach her headstone fastest, so we're sure to be wandering for a bit. A breeze carries the smell of trimmed grass. Weird question. Do you believe in the afterlife? I ask.
That's not weird. We're dying, Rufus says.
Right.
Weird answer. I believe in two afterlives.
Two?
Two.
What are they? I ask. As we walk around tombstones, many so deeply worn that the names are no longer visible, others with crosses planted in them so high they look like swords and rocks, and under large pin oak trees, Rufus tells me his theory on the afterlives.
I think we're already dead, dude.
Not everyone, just Deckers. The whole death cast thing seems too fantasy to be true. Knowing when our last day is going down so we can live it right? Straight up fantasy. The first afterlife kicks off when death cast tells us to live out our day knowing it's our last. That way we'll take full advantage of it, thinking we're still alive. Then we enter the next and final afterlife without any regrets. You get me? I nod. That's interesting. His afterlife is definitely more impressive and thoughtful than Dad's. Dad believes in the usual golden-gated island in the sky. Still, the popular afterlife is better than no afterlife, like Lydia believes. But wouldn't it be better if we already knew we were dead, so we're not living in the fear of how it happens?
Nope.
Rufus wheels his bike around a stone cherub. That defeats the purpose. It's supposed to feel real, and the risks should scare you, and the goodbyes should suck. Otherwise it feels cheap, like make a moment. If you live it right, one day should be good. If we stay longer than that, we turn into ghosts who haunt and kill, and no one wants that. We laugh on strangers' graves, and even though we're talking about our afterlives, I forget for a second that this is where we'll end up. What's the next level? Do you get on an elevator and rise up?
Nah. Your time expires and, I don't know, you fade or something and reappear in what people call heaven. I'm not religious. I believe there's some alien creator and somewhere for dead people to hang out, but I don't credit all that as God and heaven.
Me too. Ditto on the God thing. And maybe the rest of Rufus's theory is right, too. Maybe I'm already dead and have been paired with a life changer to spend my last day with as a reward for daring to do something new, like trying the Last Friend app. Maybe. What does your afterlife look like?
It's whatever you want. No limitations. If you're into angels and halos and ghost dogs, then cool. If you want to fly, you do you. If you want to go back in time, knock yourself out.
You've thought about this a lot, I say.
Late night chats with the Plutos, Rufus says.
I hope reincarnation is real, I say. I'm already finding that this one day to get everything right isn't enough. This one life wasn't enough. I tap headstones, wondering if anyone here has been reincarnated already. Maybe I was one of them. I failed past me, if so.
Me too. I want another shot, but not counting on it.
What's your afterlife look like? Coming up, there's a large tomb that resembles a pale blue teapot, and I know my mother's headstone is a few rows behind it. When I was younger, I pretended this teapot tomb was a genie's lamp. Wishing for my mother to come back and complete my family never worked. My afterlife is like a home theater, where you can rewatch your entire life from start to finish. And let's say my mother invited me into her theater. I could watch her life. I just hope someone knows what parts should fade to black, so I'm not scarred my entire afterlife. I couldn't sell Lydia on this idea, but she did admit it sounded a little cool. Oh, and there's also this transcript of everything you've ever said since birth, and... I shut up, because we reached the corner, and in the space beside my mother's plot, there's a man digging another grave while a caretaker installs a headstone with my name and dates of birth and death. I'm not even dead yet. My hands shake, and I almost drop my sanctuary. And? Rufus asks, quickly following with, "Oh." I walk toward my grave. I know graves can be dug on an accelerated schedule, but it's only been 11 hours since I even got the alert. I know my final headstone won't be ready for days, but the temporary one isn't what's throwing me off. No one should ever witness someone digging their grave. I'm hopeless too soon after believing Rufus is my life changer. Rufus drops his bike. He walks up to the grave digger and puts a hand on his shoulder. "Yo, can we have a few minutes?" The bearded grave digger, dressed in a filthy plaid shirt, turns to me and then back to my mother's plot.
"Is this the kid's mom?"
He gets back to work.
"Yeah, and you're in the middle of digging his grave,"
Rufus says as trees rustle and a shovel scoops up earth.
"Yikes. My condolences all around, but me stopping ain't gonna do anything, except slow me down. I'm knocking this out early so I can leave town, and..."
"I don't care!" Rufus takes a step back, balling up his fists, and I'm scared he's about to try to take this guy on. "So help me! Give us 10 minutes! Go dig the grave of someone who isn't standing right here!" The other guy, the one who planted my headstone, drags the gravedigger away. They both curse about Decker kids these days, but keep their distance. I want to thank the men and Rufus, but I feel myself sinking, dizzy. I manage to stay upright and reach my mother's headstone. Estrella Rosa Torres, July 7th, 1969. July 17th, 1999. Beloved wife and mother, forever in our hearts. Can I have a minute with my mom? I don't even turn around because I'm stuck staring at her end day and my birth date.
"I won't be far," Rufus says. It's possible he doesn't go very far, maybe only a couple of feet, or maybe he doesn't move at all, but I trust him. He'll be there when I turn around. Everything has come full circle between my mother and me. She died the day I was born, and now I'll be buried next to her. Reunion. When I was 8, I found it weird how she was credited as a beloved mother when the only mothering she did was carry me for 9 months. 10 years later, I know much better. But I couldn't wrap my head around her even feeling like my mom because she never had the chance to play with me, to open her arms as I took my first steps so I could crash into her, to teach me to tie my shoes, none of that or anything else. But then Dad reminded me, in a gentle way, that she couldn't do any of those things for me because the birth was complicated. Very hard, he said, and that she made sure I was okay instead of taking care of herself. That's definitely worthy of the beloved cred. I kneel before my mother's headstone. "Hey, Mom. You excited to meet me? I know you created me, but we're still strangers when you think about it. I'm sure you've thought about this already. You've had a lot of time in your home theater where the credits start rolling because you died while I cried in some nurse's arms. Maybe that nurse could have helped with the severe bleeding if she hadn't been holding me. I don't know. I'm really sorry you had to die so I could live. I really am. I hope you don't send some border patrol to keep me out when I finally die. But I know you're not like that, because of Dad's stories. One of my favorites is the one where you were visiting your mother in the hospital a few days before she died, and her roommate with Alzheimer's kept asking you if you wanted to hear her secret.
You said yes and yes over and over, even though you knew full well that she used to hide chocolate from her kids when they were younger because she had a sweet tooth. I placed my palm on the headstone's face, and it's the closest I'll come to holding her hand. Mom, am I going to be able to find love up there since I never got the chance to find it down here? She doesn't answer. There's no mysterious warmth taking over me, no voice in the wind, but it's okay. I'll know soon enough. Please look after me today, Mom, one last time. Because I know I'm not already dead like Rufus thinks we are, and I would like to have my life-changing day. See you later. I get up and turn to my open grave, which is maybe only 3 feet deep and uneven. I step in, sit down, and rest my back against the side the gravedigger hasn't finished with yet. I keep my toy sanctuary on my lap, and I must look like a kid playing with blocks in a park. Can I join you? Rufus asks. There's only really room for one. Get your own grave. Rufus steps inside anyway, kicks my feet and squeezes in, resting one leg on one of mine so he'll fit. No grave for me. I'm gonna be cremated like my family. Do you still have their ashes? We could scatter them somewhere. The Parting with Ashes forum on Countdowners is really popular, and the Plutos and I took care of that a month back, Rufus interrupts. I should try and rein in my stories about online strangers. Scattered them outside my old building. I still felt mad empty afterward, but they're home now. I want the Plutos to scatter my ashes elsewhere. Where are you thinking? Pluto? Althea Park, Rufus says. I love that park, I say. How do you know it? I went there a lot when I was younger, always with my dad. He would teach me about different clouds, and I would shout out which clouds were in the sky while I was swinging toward them. Why do you like it there so much? I don't know. I end up there a lot. It's where I kissed this girl, Kathy, for the first time. I went there after my family died, and after my first cycling marathon. Here we are, two boys sitting in the cemetery as it begins drizzling, trading stories in my half-dug grave as if we're not dying today. These moments of forgetting and relief are enough to push me through the rest of my day. Weird question. Do you believe in fate? I ask. Weird answer. I believe in two fates, Rufus says. Really? No, Rufus smiles. I don't even believe in one. You? How else do you explain us meeting? I ask. We both downloaded an app and agreed to hang out, Rufus says. But look at us. My mom and your parents are dead. My father is out of commission. If our parents were around, we wouldn't have found ourselves on Last Friend. The app is designed mainly for adults, not teens. If you can believe in two afterlives, you can believe in the universe playing Puppet Master, can't you? Rufus nods as the rain comes down harder on us. He stands first and offers me a hand. I take it. The poetry you could write about Rufus helping me out of my grave isn't lost on me. I step out and walk over to my mother's headstone, kissing her inscribed name. I leave my toy sanctuary against the stone. I turn in time to catch Rufus snapping a photo of me. Capturing moments really is his thing. I turn to my headstone one last time. Here lies Mateo Torres, Jr., July 17th, 1999. They'll add my end day in no time. September 5th, 2017. My inscription, too. It's okay that there's a blank right now. I know what it will say, and I know I'll make sure I've lived as I'm claiming. He lived for everyone. The words will wear away over time, but they'll have been true. Rufus wheels his bike along the wet and muddy path, leaving tire tracks. I follow him, my insides feeling heavier with every footstep away from my mother and my open grave, knowing I'll be back soon enough. "You sold me on fate," Rufus says. "Finish telling me about your afterlife." I do. Part 3. The Beginning. It is not death that a man should fear, but he should fear never beginning to live. Marcus Aurelius, Roman Emperor. Matteo, 12:22 p.m. 12 hours ago, I received the phone call telling me I'm going to die today. In my own Matteo way, I've said tons of goodbyes already. To my dad, best friend, and goddaughter. But the most important goodbye is the one I said to past Matteo, who I left behind at home when my last friend accompanied me into a world that has it out for us. Rufus has done so much for me, and I'm here to help him confront any demons following him. Except we can't whip out any flaming swords or crosses that double as throwing stars like in fantasy books. His company has helped me, and maybe mine will help him through any heartache, too. 12 hours ago, I received the phone call telling me I'm going to die today. And I'm more alive now than I was then.
Rufus, 12:35 p.m. I don't know where Matteo is leading me, but it's all good, because the rain stopped, and I'm recharged and ready to go after getting a strong power nap on the train ride back into the city. It sucks how I didn't dream, but no nightmares either. Win some, lose some. I'm crossing out the travel arena because it's mad busy at this time of day, as Matteo pointed out. So if we're still alive in a few hours, we have a better chance of not completely wasting away in lines. We have to wait for the herd to thin out pretty much. Shitty way to think, but I'm not wrong. I hope whatever we're doing isn't some time suck like Make a Moment. I'm betting it's charity work. Or maybe he's been secretly chatting with Amy and arranging a meetup so she and I can make things right before I kick the bucket. We've been in Chelsea for a solid 10 minutes, in the park by the pier. I'm that guy I hate, the one who walks in the bike lane when there's clearly a lane for walkers and joggers. My karma score is gonna be jacked legit. Matteo leads me toward the pier where I stop. "You gonna try and throw me over?" I ask. "You've got an extra 40 pounds on me," Matteo says. "You're safe. You said spreading your parents' and sister's ashes didn't do much for you. I thought maybe you could get some closure here." "They all died on our way upstate," I say. Fingers crossed those road barriers our car flipped over, freak accident style, have been repaired by now. But who knows? "It doesn't have to be the crash site. Maybe the river will be enough." Not sure what I'm supposed to get out of this. "I don't know either. And if you don't feel comfortable, we can turn around and do something else. Going to the cemetery gave me peace I wasn't expecting, and I want you to have that same wonder." I shrug. "We're already here. Bring on the wonder." There are no boats docked by the pier, which is a huge waste, like an empty parking lot. In July, I came by the pier a little farther uptown with Amy and Tego because they wanted to see these waterfront statues, and came back there a week later because Malcolm missed out on account of food poisoning. We walk across this arm of the pier. It's not made up of planks, otherwise I'd be too nervous to go forward. I'm straight catching Matteo's paranoia like a cold. This pier is all cement and sturdy. Not some rickety mess that's gonna collapse under me. But feel free to put down a dollar on optimism tricking the shit out of me. We reach the end, and I grab the steel gray railing so I can lean out and see the river's currents doing their thing. How are you feeling? Mateo asks. Like this whole day is a practical joke the world is playing on me? You're an actor, and any minute now, my parents, Olivia, and the Plutos are gonna run out the back of some van and surprise me. I wouldn't even be that pissed. I'd hug them and then kill them. It's a fun thought, massacre aside. Seems pretty pissed to me, Mateo says. I spent so much time being pissed at my family for leaving me, Mateo. Everyone's always running their mouth about survivor's guilt, and I get it, but I never talked about this with the Plutos. Not even Amy when we were dating, because it's too horrible. But I'm the one who left them, yo. I'm the one who got out the sinking car and swam away. I still think about if that was even me or some strong reflex, like how you can't keep your hand on a hot stove without your brain forcing it away. It would have been mad easy to sink with them, even though Deathcast hadn't hit me up yet. If it was that easy for me to almost die, maybe they should have worked harder to beat the odds and live. Maybe Deathcast was wrong. Mateo comes closer and palms my shoulder. Don't do this to yourself. There are entire forums on countdowners for Deckers confident they're special. When Deathcast calls, that's it. Game over. There isn't anything you could have done, and there isn't anything they could have done differently. I could have driven, I snap, shaking off his hand. Olivia's idea since I was tagging along. That way Decker hands wouldn't be steering the car. But I was too nervous and too pissed and too lonely. I could have bought them a few more hours. Maybe they wouldn't have given up when things looked bad. Once I was out of the car, they just sat there, Mateo. No fighting them. They only cared about getting me out. My pops reached for my door immediately, same time my mom did from behind. I could have opened my own door. It's not like my hand was jammed somewhere. I was dazed because our fucking car flew into the river, but I snapped out of it. They just gave up, though. Once my door was open, Olivia didn't even gun for the escape. I was forced to wait in the back of an ambulance with a towel that smelled like bleach around me as a team pulled their car out of the river. This was never your fault. Mateo's head is hanging low. I'm going to give you a minute alone, but I'll be waiting for you. I hope that's what you want. He walks off, taking my bike with him before I can answer. I don't think a minute is enough. Until I give in, crying harder than I have in weeks, and I hammer at the railing with the bottom of my fist. I keep going and going, hitting the railing because my family is dead, hitting it because my best friends are locked up, hitting it because my ex-girlfriend did us dirty, hitting it because I made a new dope friend and we don't even have a full day together. I stop, out of breath, like I just want to fight against 10 dudes. I don't even want a picture of the Hudson. So I turn around and keep it behind, walking toward Mateo, who's wheeling my bike in pointless circles. You win, I say. That was a good idea. He doesn't gloat like Malcolm would, or taunt me like Amy did whenever she won at Battleship. My bad for snapping. You needed to snap. He continues moving in his circle. I'm a little dizzy watching him. Truth. If you need to snap again, I'm here. Last friends for life.
Delilah Gray, 12:52 p.m. Delilah rushes to the only bookstore in the city that miraculously carries Howie Maldonado's science fiction novel, The Lost Twin of Bone Bay. Delilah speeds toward the store, staying far away from the curb ignoring the catcall from a balding man with a large gym bag and rushing past two boys with one bike. She's praying Howie Maldonado doesn't move up the interview before she can get there when she remembers there are greater stakes at play in Howie's dying life. Vin Pierce, 12:55 p.m. Deathcast called Vin Pierce at 12:02 a.m. to tell him he's going to die today, which isn't that surprising. Vin is pissed the beautiful woman with the colorful hair ignored him, pissed he never got married, pissed he was rejected by every woman on Necro this morning, pissed at his former coach who got in the way of his dreams, pissed at these two boys with a bike who are getting in the way of the destruction he's going to leave behind. The boy in the biker gear is so slow, taking up sidewalk space with the bike he's walking beside. Bikes are meant to be ridden, not carted around like a stroller. Vin barrels forward, no consequences in mind, bumping the boy's shoulder with his own. The boy sucks his teeth, but his friend grabs his arm, holding him back. Vin likes to be feared. He loves it in the outside world, but he loved it most in the wrestling ring. 4 months ago, Vin began experiencing muscle pains, but refused to acknowledge his weaknesses. Lifting weights was a struggle with poor results. Sets of 20 pull-ups became sets of 4 on good days, and his coach pulled him out of the ring indefinitely because fighting would be impossible. Illnesses have always run through his family. His father died years ago after being diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. His aunt died from a ruptured ectopic pregnancy, and so on. But Vin believed he was better, stronger. He was destined for greatness. He was sure of it, like world championships and unbelievable riches. But chronic muscle disease pinned him down, and he lost it all. Vin walks inside the gym where he spent the past 7 years, training to become the next world heavyweight champion. The smell of sweat and dirty sneakers bringing back countless memories. The only memory that matters now is the one where his coach made him pack up his locker and suggested a new career route, like being a ringside commentator or becoming a coach himself. Insulting. Vin sneaks down to the generator room and pulls a homemade bomb out of his gym bag. Vin is going to die where he was made, and he's not dying alone.
Mateo, 12:58 p.m. We pass a shop window with classic novels and new books sitting in children's chairs, like the books are hanging out in a waiting room, ready to be bought and read. I could use some lightness after the threatening grill of that man with the gym bag. Rufus takes a picture of the window. We can go in. I won't be longer than 20 minutes, I promise. We go inside the open bookstore. I love how the store name is hopeful. This is the best, worst idea ever. I have no time to actually read any of these books, but I've never been in this store before because I usually have my books shipped to me or I borrow them from the school library. Maybe a bookshelf will topple over and that's how I go out. Painful, but there are worse ways to die. I bump into a waist-high table while eyeing an antique clock on top of a bookshelf, knocking over their display copies of back-to-school books. I apologize to the bookseller, Joel, according to his name tag, and he tells me not to worry and assists me. Rufus leaves his bike in front of the store and follows me as I tour the aisles. I read the staff recommendations, all different genres praised in different handwriting, some more legible than others. I try avoiding the grief section, but two books catch my eye. One is Hello, Deborah, My Old Friend, the biography by Catherine Everett Hastings that caused some controversy. The other is that best-selling guide no one shuts up about, Talking About Death When You're Unexpectedly Dying, written by some man who's still alive.
I don't get it. They have a lot of my favorites in the thriller and young adult sections. I pause in front of the romance section, where they have a dozen books wrapped in brown paper stamped Blind Date with a Book. There are little clues on what the book is to catch your interest, like the profile of someone you meet online. Like my last friend. Have you ever dated anyone? Rufus asks. The answer feels obvious. He's nice for giving me the benefit of the doubt. Nope. I've only had crushes, but it's embarrassing to admit they were characters in books and TV shows. I missed out. Maybe in the next life. Maybe, Rufus says. I sense there's something more he wants to say. Maybe he wants to crack a joke about how I should sign up for Necro so I don't die a virgin, as if sex and love are the same thing. But he says nothing. I could be totally wrong. Was Amy your first girlfriend? I ask. I grabbed a paper-wrapped book with an illustration of a criminal running away, holding an oversized playing card. A heart. Heart stealer. First relationship, Rufus says, playing with this spinner of New York City-themed postcards. But I had things for other classmates in my old school. They never went anywhere, but I tried. Did you ever get close to someone? He slides a postcard of the Brooklyn Bridge out the spinner. You can send them a postcard. Postcards. I smile as I grab one. 2, 4, 6, 12. You had a lot of crushes, Rufus says. I move for the cash register, where Joel assists me again. We should send postcards to people, you know? I keep it vague because I don't want to break the news to this bookseller that the customers he's ringing up are dying at 17 and 18. I'm not going to ruin his day. The Plutos, any classmates? I don't have their addresses, Rufus says. Send it to the school. They'll have the address for anyone you graduated with. It's what I want to do. I buy the mystery book and the postcards, thank Joel for his help, and we leave. Rufus said the key to his relationships was speaking up. I can do this with the postcards, but I have to use my voice, too. I was 9 when I bothered my dad about love, I say, looking through the postcards again at places in my own city I never visited. I wanted to know if it was under the couch or high up in the closet where I couldn't reach yet. He didn't say that love is within or love is all around you. Rufus wheels his bike beside me as we pass this gym. I'm hooked. What did he say? That love is a superpower we all have, but it's not always a superpower I'd be able to control, especially as I get older. Sometimes it'll go crazy, and I shouldn't be scared if my power hits someone I'm not expecting it to. My face is warm, and I wish I had the superpower of common sense, because this isn't something I should have ever said out loud. That was stupid. Sorry. Rufus stops and smiles. Ah, I like that. Thanks for that story, Super Mateo. It's actually Mega Master Mateo Man. Get it right, sidekick. I look up from the postcards. I really like his eyes. Brown. And tired, even though we got some rest. How do you know when love is love? Glass shatters and we're suddenly thrown backward through the air as fire reaches out toward a screaming crowd. This is it. I slam against the driver's side of a car, my shoulder banging into the rearview mirror. My vision fades. Darkness, fire, darkness, fire. My neck creaks when I turn, and Rufus is beside me, his beautiful brown eyes closed. He's surrounded by my postcards of the Brooklyn Bridge, the Statue of Liberty, Union Square, and the Empire State Building. I crawl toward him and tense as I reach out to him. His heart is pounding against my wrist. His heart, like mine, desperately doesn't want to stop beating, especially not in chaos like this. Our breaths are erratic,
disturbed and frightened. I have no idea what happened, just that Rufus is struggling to open his eyes, and others are screaming. But not everyone. There are bodies on the ground, faces kissing cement, and beside one woman with very colorful hair who's struggling to get up is another, except her eyes are skyward, and her blood is staining a rain puddle.
Rufus, 1:14 p.m. Yo, a little over 12 hours ago, that Deathcast dude hit me up, telling me I'm a goner today. I'm sitting on a street curb, hugging my knees like I did in the back of the ambulance when my family died. Straight shaken now over that explosion. The kind you only see in summer blockbusters. Police and ambulance sirens are blasting, and the firefighters are handling business on the burning gym. But it's too late for mad people. Deckers need to start wearing special collars or jackets, something that'll clue us in on not flocking in one place. That could have been me and Mateo if we were a minute or two slower. Maybe, maybe not. But I know this. A little over 12 hours ago, I got a phone call telling me I'm gonna die today. And I thought I made my peace with that. But I've never been more scared in my life of what's gonna go down later.
Mateo, 1:28 p.m. The fire has been put out. My stomach has been screaming at me for the past 20 minutes to feed it, as if I can call time out on my end day to have another meal without wasting valuable time, and as if Rufus and I weren't almost just killed in an explosion that claimed other Deckers. Witnesses are speaking to the cops, and I don't know what they could possibly be saying. The explosion that destroyed the gym came out of nowhere. I sit beside Rufus, his bike, and my bookstore bag. The postcards are scattered all around us, and they can stay there on the ground. I don't have it in me to write anything when there are Deckers who've now found themselves in body bags on the way to the morgue. I can't trust this day.
Rufus, 1:46 p.m. I gotta keep it moving. I want more than anything to sit across from the Plutos and talk about nothing. But the next best thing to break me out of this mood is a bike ride. It's what I did after my parents and Olivia died, and when Amy broke up with me, and this morning after beating down Peck and getting the alert. Once we're away from the chaos, I get on the bike, flexing the brakes. Mateo dodges my gaze. "Please get on," I say. It's the first time I've spoken since being thrown in the air like a wrestler. "No," Mateo says. "I'm sorry. It's not safe." "Mateo." "Rufus?" "Mateo." "Rufus?" "Please, Mateo. I gotta ride after what went down, and I don't want to leave you behind. We're supposed to be living, period. We know how this ends for both of us, but I don't want to look back on any moment thinking we straight wasted it. This isn't some dream. And we won't wake up from this. I don't know what else I can do. Get on my knees and beg? It's not my style, but I'll give it a go if it gets him to come with me." Mateo looks seasick. "Promise to go slow, okay? Avoid going down any hills and through puddles?" "Promise." I hand him the helmet, which he's refusing. But there's no way in hell I'm more at risk than he is. He straps the helmet on, hangs the bookstore bag from the handlebar, climbs on the rear pegs, and grips my shoulders. "Is this too tight? I just don't want to fall, helmet or not." "No, you're fine." "Cool. Ready?" "Ready." I pedal, slowly, feeling the burn in my calves as I carry two people forward. It's like running up a hill. Find a good rhythm and put the police and corpses and destroyed gym behind us.
Deirdre Clayton, 1:50 p.m. Deathcast did not call Deirdre Clayton because she isn't dying today, but she's going to prove them wrong. Deirdre is on the ledge of her apartment building roof, 8 stories high. There are 2 delivery men watching her, either interested in catching her with the couch they're moving into the building, or else placing bets on if she's a decker or not. The blood and broken bones on the pavement will settle their wager. This isn't the first time Deirdre has found herself higher than the world. 7 years ago, back when she was in high school, and months after Deathcast services became available to the public, Deirdre was challenged to a fight after school, and when Charlotte Simmons and instigators and other students, who only knew Deirdre as that lesbian with the dead parents, arrived at what was supposed to be the battlefield, Deirdre was on the roof instead. She never understood how the way she loves could drag such hatred out of others, and she refused to stick around to find the love everyone hated her for. Except back then she had her childhood best friend to talk her down. Today, Deirdre is alone, knees wobbling, and crying because as much as she wants to believe in better days, her job prevents her from doing so. Deirdre works at Make a Moment, where she's charging deckers for thrills and fake experiences, fake memories. She doesn't understand why these deckers aren't home with loved ones, particularly those 2 teen boys today who, as they were leaving, talked about how underwhelming the virtual reality experience was. It's wasted time. The boys from earlier reminded her of a short story she'd finished working on this morning, something for her eyes only that has kept her distracted in the quiet times at work. Her story is set in an alternate world where Deathcast has another branch called Lifecast, and this extension informs deckers of when they will be reincarnated, so their families and friends will know how to find them in their next life. It's centered around 15-year-old twin sisters, Angel and Skylar, who are devastated to learn one twin is about to die and immediately seek out Lifecast's services to find out when Skylar will be reincarnated. Angel is upset because she won't be reunited with her sister for another 7 years, when Skylar will be reincarnated as the son of some family in Australia. Skylar dies, saving her sister's life, and it ends with a devastated Angel depositing a $100 bill into an old piggy bank to start funding her way to Australia in 7 years to welcome her sister back into the world, albeit as an infant boy. Deirdre thought she would continue that story, but scratch that now. Lifecast doesn't exist, and she's not waiting around for Deathcast to let her know when her time is up. This is a world of violence and fear, and children dying without having lived, and she wants no part of it. It will be so easy to jump. She stands on one foot, her entire body shaking, surely about to tumble forward any moment now. She once scaled a rooftop at work, in their virtual parkour station, but that was an illusion. Death is prophesied in Deirdre's name, that of a heroine in Irish mythology who took her own life. Deirdre looks down, ready to fly, when 2 boys on a bike turn the corner. They resemble the boys from earlier. Deirdre reaches deep within herself, far past the place where lies and hopelessness come easily, and even beneath the very honest truth where she's okay with the impacting relief that comes with flying off this roof. She sees 2 boys living, and this makes her feel less dead inside. Intent may not be enough to cause her to actually die. She knows this from the countless other mornings when she's woken up to ugliness. But when faced with the chance to prove Deathcast wrong, Deirdre makes the right decision and lives.
Mateo, 1:52 p.m. This bike isn't the worst thing. I squeeze Rufus's shoulder when he makes a sharp left, dodging some delivery guys who are staring up into the sky instead of moving a couch into a building, and we continue sailing down the street. I felt really wobbly when he first got going, but as he picks up a good enough speed to throw a breeze our way, I appreciate the control I'm entrusting to him. It's freeing. I'm not expecting to go any faster than we are, but it's more exciting than the make-a-moment skydiving. Yeah. Riding a bike is more thrilling than, quote-unquote, jumping out of a plane. If I weren't such a coward, or a decker, I would lean against Rufus, shifting my weight against him. I'd put my arms out and close my eyes. But it's too risky, so I keep holding him, which works for me too. But when we reach our destination, I'm going to do something small and brave.
Rufus, 2:12 p.m. I slow down as we turn into Althea Park. Mateo's hands slip off my shoulders, and my bike is immediately lighter. I brake. I turn to see if he's broken his face or busted his head open despite the helmet, but he's jogging toward me, and a smile cracks on his face. He's all good. Did you jump off?
I did.
Mateo takes off the helmet. You didn't want me riding the bike, and now you're going ahead and throwing yourself off one?
I was in the moment.
I want to take full credit, but he's had this in him all along. Always wanting to do something exciting, just being too scared to go out and do it.
You feeling better?
Mateo asks.
A little, I admit.
I get off the bike. I limp toward the deserted playground as some college-age-looking dudes play handball in a nearby court, splashing in the puddles as they chase after the ball whenever someone misses. My basketball shorts are damp and dirty from the cemetery. Same for Mateo's jeans, so the wet bench doesn't bother us when we sit. I hate that we were there for that.
I know. You never want to see someone die, even if you never knew them.
It pulled me out of my bullshit zone. My whole I'm ready for whatever is gonna hit us thing is bullshit, and I'm scared shitless. We could legit die in the next 30 seconds from rogue bullets or something, and I hate that. Whenever I get into this freaking out headspace, I end up here. Never fails.
But good times brought you here too, he says. Like finishing your first marathon.
He takes a deep breath.
And having your first kiss with some girl.
Yeah.
That kiss bothers him, huh?
I guess my gut was right.
I stay shut for a solid stretch of time, only staring at squirrels climbing trees and birds chasing each other on foot.
Have you ever played Gladiator?
I know the game, he says.
Good. Have you ever played?
I've seen others play.
So no.
No.
I stand, pull Mateo by his wrists, and lead him to the monkey bars. I challenge you to a gladiator match.
I can't refuse, can I?
Definitely not.
We just survived an explosion. What's a little more pain?
Jungle Gym Gladiator isn't crazy like an age-old Coliseum match, but I've seen schoolmates get hurt before. Hell, I'm the reason some of them got hurt. Two players, gladiators, swing from the monkey bars into each other to try and knock their opponent down. It's the most barbaric childhood game. Mad fun. We're both fairly tall, so we could just tiptoe and grab hold of the monkey bars. But I mini-hop and lift myself up like I'm doing pull-ups. Mateo hops and takes hold, but has zero upper body strength. So he falls back on his feet 10 seconds later. He jumps again and holds himself up this time.
I count down from three as we swing toward each other, closing the small distance between us. I kick at him and he swerves to the side, almost falling. I lift my legs higher, throwing my legs around his midriff. He tries breaking out of my grapple as I rattle him, but no dice. My hands are kind of aching, so when he lets go, laughing, I fall with him onto the mat. I bang against the mats, shocks chasing each other around my body. But the pain doesn't kill me. We're side by side with each other, laughing while we massage our aching elbows and legs. Our backs are wetter, and we keep slipping while trying to get up. Idiots. Mateo gets it together and helps me up. I won, right? I say. I think it's a tie, he says. Rematch? I'm good. I'm pretty sure I saw my life flash before my eyes when we were falling. I smile. Let me get real with you, Mateo. I say his name a lot, even though I'm obviously talking to him. Because it's just cool. Seriously. Mateo. Past few months have been brutal. My life always felt over, even without the alert. There were days I believed I could prove Deathcast wrong and ride my bike into the river. But on top of being scared now, I'm pissed off because there's so much I'll never get to have. Time. Other stuff, like... You're not going to off yourself today, right? Mateo asks. I'm safe from myself, I promise. I don't want everything over. Please promise you won't go dying before me. I can't see that. Only if you promise the same thing. We can't both promise this. Then I'm not promising my promise, Mateo says. I don't want you to see me die, but I can't watch you die either. That's messed up. You're really gonna go down as the Decker who didn't promise to grant another Decker his dying wish? Forcing myself to watch you die is not something I'll promise you. You're my last friend, and it would wreck me. You don't deserve to die, Mateo. I don't think anyone deserves to die. Except serial killers, right? He doesn't answer because he probably thinks I won't like his answer. If anything, it only further proves my point. Mateo doesn't deserve to die. A handball bounces our way, and Mateo races past me to catch it. This guy chases after the ball, but Mateo gets to it first and tosses it to him. Thanks, the guy says. Homeboy is really pale, like he doesn't leave his apartment nearly enough. What a shitty stormy day to come out and play. I'm guessing he's 19 or 20, but I'm not ruling out he's our age. No problem, Mateo says. He's turning away when he sees my bike. Nice. Is that a track? It is. Got it for off-road races. Do you ride one? Mine got wrecked. Brake cable got busted and the seat clamp was all screwy. I'm buying another one when I get a job that pays more than $8 an hour, he says. Take mine, I say. I can do this. I walked to my bike, which carried me through a brutal race and everywhere else I wanted to go, and wheel it toward this guy. It's your lucky day, seriously. My friend isn't about me riding this thing, so you can have it.
You serious?
You sure? Mateo asks. I nod. It's yours, I tell the guy. Have at it. I'm moving soon anyway and won't be able to bring it. The dude throws the handball over to his friends, who've been shouting for him to come back and play. He sits on the bike and plays with the gears.
Wait. You didn't jack this from someone, right?
Nope.
And it's not broken. Is that why you're leaving it behind?
It's not broken. Look, do you want it or not?
We good, we good. Can I pay you something?
I shake my head.
We good, I say back. Mateo gives the guy the helmet, and he doesn't put it on before riding back to his friends. I get my phone out and snap photos of him riding my bike. His back to me as he stands on the pedals, while his friends play handball.